Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kara Warren. And on today's episode, we have Guillaume Dupont, export manager of Maison Agur, based in the Basque country of Spain. He's on the program today to help us learn more about the Basque gastronomic culture relating to the worlds of Osorati, Petit Agur, and Bayon Ham. Guillaume, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. How's everything doing in the Basque country? Because I'm lucky to have you from afar.
Yes, very well. Everything's very good. We're in the middle of milking season. Weather is looking bright and warm. Very good here.
Oh, so your spring is starting, actually.
Well, it shouldn't, actually. It should be the rainiest part of the year, but it's actually pretty dry at the moment.
Oh, geez. Okay. Well, that's good. You know, that's the funny thing. I always think of rain in the Basque Country, but I'm glad you're getting a little sunlight. So cool. You know, I'm only starting to learn about Agur. You know, I've only heard about them for the last few years, and I've always enjoyed Osorati. But could you, for the listeners, briefly explain what you do for Maison Agur?
Yeah, totally. So Maison Agur is one of the largest family dairies in the Basque Country, and I'm basically in charge of all the export sales for the company. So everything that's outside of France will go through me when it's sales related.
Cool. And so Maison Agur is considered a producer. It's not an exporter. It's just a producer, right?
No, exactly. We actually collect milk, make cheese with it, age cheese, and we do sell our own cheese all over the world.
Cool. And how many different cheeses are there now that you guys are you know, selling, at least in the US? I like to narrow it down because I know it can be sold internationally around Europe. And but in the US, how many cheeses are you selling?
So most of what we're selling is the PDO Osorati, which is a press-based sheep's milk cheese. That's probably 75% of the cheeses that we sell in the US. The rest being using the same technology, but with different sizes, different shapes, and different aging profiles.
Cool. And Osorati, like you said, it's a sheep's milk cheese. It's one of the ones that I'm like always in cheese shops. I see it and I gravitate towards because it's one of the easiest to like sheep's milk cheeses. Why do you think it's so special? Why is it so approachable, do you think?
You're right in saying that. I've heard many, many people and many cheesemongers that were saying that Osorati was the cheese that made them fall in love with cheese. I think one of the reasons about it is that it's so well balanced between being not too strong, but strong enough, delicate, having a depth of flavor that's pretty much unique, very sweet. The texture is very easy to like. It's a crowd pleaser, but it's also a very delicate, sort of fragrant cheese. It's like every bite will tell a different story.
Yeah. I think you nailed it. I think that's exactly what it is. And I want to actually dive into some of the history and hopefully you can help me with this because I tried to do my research before. But so one of the cool things I was realizing is that as an AOC protected product from 1980, it's one of three sheep's milk cheeses that were protected. The other two were Roquefort and Brochu, which is very cool. But then I realized looking at the AOP standard, it can be pasteurized. Is that correct?
yes, absolutely. And that's actually that's a topic I've been talking about to most of my customers and a lot of the cheesemongers around the world as well. There's always that label that people love to put on cheese is that that's a raw milk cheese, so it's got to be better, which is true to some extent. And for some cheese types, mostly soft base and blue rinds, in the case of Osoyoratti, raw milk Osoyoratti and a pasteurized one are just two different cheeses with two pretty different flavor profiles and different texture profiles as well.
Gotcha. And in the US, we're getting the AOP, the pasteurized version, correct?
Pasteurized, yes, pasteurized. There's quite a high risk of being red flagged by the authorities. The reason being that Osoyoratti's has to have a natural rind. And some of the bacteria we're trying to avoid do like natural rinds that like to bloom when they're shipped in cartons for weeks throughout the Atlantic. So we try not to take that risk.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, working in a similar business, I totally understand. I always wish for like at least a thermalized milk product one day, but I understand it's really tough. And it is still a great cheese as a pasteurized cheese. So I applaud you for making it work the best you can.
Totally. There's also two things that we can do with pasteurized milk that we would not do with raw milk. We do produce about 25% of our Osoyoratti with raw milk. There's two things about them. The texture of raw milk will always be a little drier. And we find that the pasteurized version has like a softer texture, which is nicer in mouth. But also the raw milk Osoyoratti evolves really quickly. So after 5-6 months, it starts to be a bit aggressive and it loses its complexity. Whereas our pasteurized version, we age up to 17 months here. And it just adds up to that sweetness, that nuttiness of the product without the aggressivity, which is really interesting.
Oh, that is very interesting that it's more helpful being pasteurized in that way for the shelf life and the evolution of it. That's cool.
Exactly. And the raw milk product has got a very rustic profile. Mm-hmm. So if your palate is not used to very strong, very spicy, very aggressive types of cheeses, then the pasteurized version is probably a better option.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. I like that point. So actually, I want to segue now to the milk because I understand that's also very particular and special. Can you tell us about like the breeds of the sheep and what's going on with the milk?
Absolutely, because that's central to why Osoyoratti is special and different from similar types of cheeses that will be made in other regions of France and Europe. And I'm thinking also about sheep's milk, Spanish cheeses that are made differently. We can start with the territory and how it looks. The Basque Country starts on the ocean shore of the Atlantic. It's the corner of Spain and France, and the Basque Country basically crosses the border between the two countries. Actually, it's called the Basque Country because it's its own country, its own territory with culture, unicity, and its own language. But also the landscape is just one of the greenest places you'll find in Europe. Just because of that landscape between ocean and mountains, it's also the tip of the Pyrenees. The humidity from the ocean just gathers up on those mountains and it makes it one of the rainiest places in Europe. It rains more than it does in the UK. It rains more than it does in Northern Europe. And hence that place is just so green. It's very hilly and it's the soil is clay. So it's not really good for crops. We can't really grow anything here efficiently. So most of what farmers do here is raise animals. And because it's hilly, sheep just evolve better in this type of environment. So historically, we've been herding sheep here for thousands and thousands of years. The sheep that we're using are very well adapted to a hilly landscape. It's very steep. There's not really any flat surfaces. So you need the type of sheep that's actually used to to this type of territory. We have three breeds that we use for Osso Irati. Two of them are called the Manesh. One's got the red head without horns, and one's got the black head with the big twisty horns.
I've seen that online. That's very cool. Exactly. I've seen that photo.
It's actually on the wheel of Osso Irati. You have imprinted on the rind a head of one of those sheep. So they're the most rustic, the most traditional, and the most ancient breed that we use. The third one is called Basco Béarnaise, and it's used on the eastern side of the PDO zone, which is neighboring the Béarn region.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. Yes. So
these are the only three breeds that people can use to make Osso Irati.
Wow. So it's very distinct, and I like that it's on the label. Like, I was staring at the at your sticker, and I was like, wait, is that the head of a sheep on the rind right there?
Exactly. That's where it all starts. That's where it all starts. The milk that is produced by those three breed of sheep is very rich, very, very high in protein, very, very high in fat. But they don't make a lot.
Oh, sure.
They don't make a lot of milk. So it's just in liters that would be between a liter to a liter 20 a day throughout two milking moments. So 6 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the afternoon, milked twice a day. The total would be a liter to a liter 20, which means one sheep across a whole campaign of milking, which doesn't last the whole year, be 6 to 8 months every year, would produce just under 300 liters per campaign.
Wow. And I was thinking, like, how many sheep does each herd have then? Because, again, the volume's not so much.
No, the volume's not so much. They're very small herds. They're very small farms, usually family-run, inherited from their parents, from their grandparents, from their great-grandparents. It's hard to manage a high amount of sheep in such a territory that we have, because it's hilly, it's even up in the mountains, and the further east you go, the higher the mountains. In most mountain regions, the head count would be about 200 to 250.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And if you go down to the plains, the larger farms would be 600 heads.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of fun to manage, I bet.
Yeah. No, but that's why we have to work with so many different farms, because one farm would not amount for a lot. If you 200 sheep would make 300 liters each, you'd have 6,000 liters. We need 5 to 6 liters to make a kilo of cheese, so the ratio is 6 to 1. You would not be able to make a lot of cheese with just one farm.
Yeah. No, that's pretty difficult. And I was going to ask you, you were saying the grasses as well are very distinct. It has a lot of natural flowers or certain minerals in it that you look out for too?
Definitely, and for several reasons. The first one being the climate. Mm-hmm. It's very humid. It's very wet. It rains a lot. So the grass grows really, really fast. Like, you have your mow your lawn here every week during summer. It's a nightmare. But because it's never too cold in winter, like we have days above 15 degrees Celsius at the moment, the grass grows all year round. So it keeps growing in winter. Which makes for a really, really rich paddocks and really rich pastures. But also because part of the Osso Irati PDO book of rules that you have to follow, the natural cycle of milking and lambing and reproduction of sheep has to be respected. So the campaign doesn't last all year round. We only collect milk from early December to the end of July, knowing that a sheep would produce for 6 months. And the rest of the year, they will be left free in the mountains, eating whatever's up there.
Oh, so you have the transhumanists as well
yes.
in this?
We have transhumance during which the sheep would go up in the mountains. They will mix together, and the shepherds, or sometimes the farmer, will go up and live in that little cabin in the mountains and stay with the sheep, where they can still milk, but only to make cheese up there in the mountains. So if you get to travel to the Basque Country, mm-hmm. try and look for cheese that's made during that time, because it's very hard to find outside of the Basque Country. It's very, very little volumes. But the shepherds would be allowed, be able to do 5, 6, up to 10 for the biggest herds, wheels a day, for a few weeks in summer.
Oh, that's very cool. I'll have to look next time I'm out there. I'll have to look for that. That's very cool. And then for the creameries, it's two facilities, or is it just one facility making the Osso Orati?
So just for Agour, it's two.
Okay.
Our main site, which is our original site, built in 1981, where we make all the larger volumes, all the larger lines. And then we have a small site that's built up in the mountains, actually in the Irati Valley. It's the only cheese-making facility in the Irati Valley now.
And the Irati Valley is like a forest I was reading online? Am I making that up?
It's the largest beech forest in Europe.
Cool.
It's very protected, and it's one of the birthplace of Osso Orati. So Osso is a valley in Béarn, in the eastern part of the zone. And Orati is that forest, that valley, in the Basque Country, up in the Pyrenees, and it's on the border between Spain and France right now.
Cool. That's very cool. So it's a very special place, and some smaller batch cheeses are made there, you're saying?
Exactly. Some smaller batch cheeses, because it's a six people run facility. Most of the work's done with their hands, like flipping wheels, pressing cheese. We can make small batches there. And so for us, it's a place where we can make one of our most special cheese. That's a single breed, Osso Orati, which we make with the black sheep, the black head Manèche. We only use milk from that very sheep because it's the most rustic and the one that produces the least amount of milk. But it's also the richest milk. But because it produces a little less, farmers were starting to turn around and say, like, well, I want to use the other breeds because they make more money.
Yeah, they have to have some business. They have to make some more cheese.
That's it. So we're like, okay, we're going to pay you more for milk from Blackhead Manèche if you're able to supply us with full tanks of Blackhead Manèche milk, then we're going to make a cheese out of it.
Got it. And the super special cheeses that you're making at the smaller creamery are like which cheeses, just to name a few, so we can look, next time we're in Spain or in Basque Country, we can look for them.
Yeah. So we do a drain paste, little sort of tiny, tiny betmal that we do with sheep's milk. That's called Arpea.
Okay.
The Arpea is one of the most surprising cheeses that I've ever had to taste. It's unlike any others. It was actually invented through a mistake. We were trying to look for new cheese recipes, and I mean, this was one of the trials. I'm like, this is not what we're looking for, but we're going to keep that.
Yep, I love that.
it's really sweet. I compare it to like a cloud of sheep's milk. Like, it's sweet, it's fragrant. You can taste the pasture, the mountains, and it's really, really special. It doesn't travel that well, so some distributors in the US actually take the risk to import it.
It is coming to the US, that cheese.
It is. Okay. I wouldn't exactly know which shop you could get it at, but
sure,
that's an information I can get.
Yeah.
But it's a risk to take because it doesn't travel that well. We also make a cheese. It's a soft paste. It's basically a sheep's milk brie that took the name of a chapel that's up there in a mountain called Saint Sauveur.
Okay.
So technically a sheep's milk brie. It's very mild, very soft, and it's just very fresh. Like, it's perfect for warm days, summer, and like what, when you're not really looking for raclette, but the other way.
Something a little tamer, a little less heavy. I getcha.
Exactly. And we also make a sheep's milk crottin that we call picora. The picora is exactly the same technology as a goat's milk crottin with sheep's milk.
Oh, lovely.
So it's softer and lighter than a goat's milk crottin. Not as much acidity. It's very sweet. It's only 80 grams, but it's, I call it a one portion cheese. Like it's one for one person.
No, totally. I mean, a crottin is the size of a little nugget, basically. So
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I do want to ask you then about another cheese that's not made in that very small creamery in the forest, but I would like to ask you about Petit de Gour, which is a smaller cheese tome that we've had a conversation about at Fancy Food in Vegas. You were telling me, but can you tell the listeners why it exists and what's special about it?
So an Osoyerati would be either 10 pounds or 5 pounds. These are the two different formats you're allowed to make. Technically, they've given us two formats because it's one way to control how they age through time, because the size is very important to the aging process. And that's what farmers used to sell. So after milking the sheep, basically after you've milked the sheep, you have to start making cheese right away because there was no pasteurization, no thermization back in the days. You had to process it straight away. That's why cheese was invented, just to preserve milk. Mm-hmm. So the size of cheese that they were selling at the market were either the 5 pound wheel or the 10 pound wheel, but you can't control the amount of milk that you've just had twice a day. So after you've produced that many amount of 10 pound or 5 pound wheel, you always had a little bit of a leftover, which the farmers were using for their own consumption, and that they usually end up being like a 1.5 to 2 ounces. There are 2 pounds type of wheel. So it's a very small wheel that they would use for their own consumption. So we've decided to make a product out of it.
Yeah. I love that it's like this little drum.
Exactly.
That, you know, like I guess the closest, it's not the same cheese at all, but the same size format would be Tête de Moine.
Yes.
So I actually does it work on a Girolle as well if you wanted to use it on there, or is it how do you serve this cheese?
There are many ways to serve this cheese. You can cut in half, in cut in quarters, cut in eighth. You can slice it sideways, so you have like little rounds or half moons. And the Girolle works as well. It don't tell the Swiss I told you that, but yeah, you can use the Girolle.
We'll have to hide from them. You know, they'll look for me and you later, and we'll see if we make it. But I'm glad that the cheese exists. I was also looking at that label, and just correct me if this is from another company or not, but I think it's on your label. There was Ardi Gasna. And I wanted to know, what does that mean? Because I've seen that written on the label before, and I was curious what it meant.
Gashna means cheese in Basque, and Ardi means sheep. So it means sheep's milk cheese.
Simple as that then. Okay, cool. Yeah, because I mean, I'm going to also quiz you about another thing on the Osoyerati label. There's a bunch of Oscara, is that the language to say from the Basque? Oscara, yeah. And I was wondering, like, what is the saying on your label? Do you know? Could you translate it for us? Because it looks like a lot of fun letters together, and I'm like, well, this is obviously another language, and I'm curious what it says. So
yes, so it's part of the mission of our company at Agor. Is to help preserve and promote the Basque language. It's actually part of our company policy. And everything that we do and everything that we communicate, if you jump on LinkedIn, if you jump on our Instagram, everything will be bilingual. The minimum would be Basque and French, or Basque and English, Basque and Spain. But the Basque is the common denominator to everything. That's how we communicate. I'd say over half of the people inside the company, in the offices, or in the manufacturing area will speak Basque as well as a native language.
Oh, cool. So obviously you speak the language, and maybe some people at Interval. Does anyone at Interval, the group that you work with to help import,
we don't have any Basque native people here.
Oh, man. I wanted to throw a joke out there.
They don't. And I'd say about 50% of people here at Agour do speak the language, and 50% don't. And I'm part of that 50%. I'm ashamed to say.
Oh, no.
I only know a few words and a few phrases.
It's still very impressive. I know it's really limited to that area, so it's very special, like the cheeses. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, Guillaume, I just want to take a quick break. We'll just have a word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
All right, welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Kara Warren. I'm here with Guillaume Dupont of Maison Agour, which is famous for their Osorati cheese and Bayonne ham, actually. We should start gravitating towards the ham because
okay.
I've seen it around the shows. I've seen it in the shops. What can you describe what Bayonne ham is? I feel like I won't do the justice. I won't do it justice. So what is Bayonne ham?
No problem. Just like cheese was invented to preserve milk, cured hams were invented to preserve meat. Bayonne ham is our local PGI, so protected geographic indication. It's our local recipe of cured ham made in the southwest of France around the Adour River, which jumps in the ocean in Bayonne. So it's a leg of pork that's been preserved in salt.
Got it. And is it made with a special breed of pig, and does it have a special diet as well?
Yes. So the Bayonne ham is a PGI, so a protective name, and it's made with PGI ingredients as well. So the first PGI ingredient that we use is the pork meat, which is a PGI southwest of France pork meat. We use Duroc breed pigs, which is quite a small breed of pigs that grow really well here. We do grow a lot of corn in the region, and most of what they eat is grain. So they grain fed pork by opposition to the acorn fed Iberian pig. So that's a PGI meat that we use. So it's made in the region. There's a certain set of rules. To make it, you're looking for color, you're looking to fat content, you're looking to a certain diet, certain breeds, and a certain region as well. So that's the only meat that you're allowed to use to make Bayonne ham. And we do use another PGI ingredient, which is the salt. Salt is as special as the meat that we use. It's a spring salt. So a few million years ago, there used to be an ocean where we actually live. There's no ocean here anymore, but the salt has stayed underground. So under the Pyrenees, you have salt that's left over from the ocean, and springs actually run on those salt veins that are under the mountains, which we get from 80 meters underground. A spring that's three times as salty as seawater.
Oh, wow.
However, the salt that we get out of it completely naturally through evaporation from the sun, there's no treatment, it's not whitened or anything. The salt is not as salty as sea salt. And that's one of the reasons why Bayonham is so delicate, so fruity, and not as salty as other types of cured meat.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's very interesting. Okay. So you have this amazing salt that's working its way, it's curing it. How long is it cured for? What's the normal amount of time for a ham like this?
So the minimum would be 9 months.
Cool.
There's a first step where you actually salt the meat. So it's left there for 10 to 15 days. Then it goes on to maturation, which is still in a cold area, pretty humid. We don't want to lose too much humidity at that point, which would be 3 to 4 months. And then it goes on to drying, and drying would be a minimum of 5 months up to, we can age it up to 21, 24 months.
Okay. So that's a good amount of time. And then when it comes to it, is there like a good way to cut this kind of ham?
The traditional bone-in ham would be cut sideways, just like we can see the Spanish do with Iberico or the Italians do with San Daniele, when you have that whole leg on the stand and you have that long knife that cortador used to cut little slices out of it. So that's one way, and that's the most traditional way to do it. We do now make deboned ham, and especially for exports reason, where there's a lot of countries where we allow to export the ham, but not the bone. Mm. So that will go through the slicer.
Got it. So are you an expert at cutting it by hand now? Or I like doing it myself.
I have become an expert, because that's one of the ways we actually do trade shows, expos, and we can do it in certain shops as well. It's one of the best ways to taste the ham, because it's just the product as it is, untouched, unprocessed. The moment you start removing the bone, I mean, it's not a gentle process, and it starts changing the texture of the meat. And so, as much as possible, try and taste the ham untouched, which means bone in as it is, out of the bone. Then you can move on to the deboned leg out of the meat slicer. And I mean, we do some pre-slice as well, which is not, to my sense, the best way to taste it. It's the most convenient way to taste it, and it's the most convenient way to get people around you to taste it as well. But I feel that you lose, even if you get all the flavor out of it, and it's quite fruity, it's quite sweet, but you lose a bit of the texture out of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in regards to like the fat when you're cutting it, do you ever do the trick where you take some of the fat and put it back on to keep it more moist? Is that part of it too?
Totally, because the skin and the fat protect them, the meat.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start removing that layer so that you can cut the meat, and you always leave a little bit of the fat on the slice, yeah, because that's flavor as well. But the first layer of fat and skin, rind, that you actually get to remove, put it back on top, and that'll protect the meat from rotting on the first layer.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I kind of wish I could have one at my house, but I think my partner wouldn't be into that. I might be overloaded.
Because every time you pass by, you have to cut yourself a little slice.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. So I have a fun question for you. Have you ever had an Osoirati and Bayonne ham sandwich?
Absolutely.
Yeah, right? It is possible. Okay.
It's got to be something you have in your fridge at all times. So a nice slice of fresh bread, a bit of Osoirati, a slice of Bayonne ham, they just fit perfectly together.
But I've never had this sandwich, and now I was like, since I was researching for you, I was like, oh my God, I need to make this sandwich. What am I doing with my life, you know?
Definitely. That can even go under the grill, because Osoirati having a high fat content, it melts pretty well.
Ooh, score. Okay. Challenge accepted.
Paneng ham is something you can cook with, so you can grill it as well. Originally, if you go to a dairy farmer here and you go into the barn, they'll always be between one and four legs hanging on the roof because it's part of the staple diet here. People used to salt their dishes with little dice of ham.
That's
one of the uses here. It's actually a cooking product, which is why also here in the region, if you go to a supermarket, you can find thick slices of cured ham, which is something people hate everywhere else.
Wow.
But that's because people use it for cooking.
Yeah. So it's almost like you're saying, it's like a salt.
It's thick as bacon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like a salt pork. So they could like, I don't know if they make beans with it or something like that, but
it's flavoring most dishes actually in Basque gastronomy. Just like with espelette pepper.
Mm-hmm.
Paneng ham, osoyrati, you have 75% of the dishes that we eat here on here.
Awesome, awesome. And then what's the famous drink pairing to go with this? Is there a special drink for this?
Well, the local drink which actually was very surprised to find in a lot of different places in the U.S. is Chagardeau. Chagardeau is the Basque cider.
Oh, okay.
Which we make with a wild variety of apples. They're very small. They're not really good to eat because they're very, very sour.
Got it. So, is that the one where they shoot it in the air as well? Like it's from very high up?
And so it's you pour it from very high up or straight out of the barrel. For one reason is that because it's so low in sugar, it doesn't have bubbles naturally. It's only just fizzy.
Cool.
So you air it to actually get more of the bubbles into your drink. But that makes for a drink, you have to drink really quickly as well because the bubbles that you create this way disappear as quickly as you've made them.
Yeah. Also, it's kind of a messy, fun thing. Like in my experience, I'm not very good at it. let's just put it like that. I don't always make it to the glass.
Yeah.
Cool.
One way to do it cleanly and properly would be to actually go for it, just like if you're pouring like a normal drink. If you try and be gentle, that's where you spill it everywhere.
Yeah, that was my fault. That's exactly what happened. I was trying to be gentle. Doesn't work that well. So I wanted to ask you one more favorite thing of mine that I think you showed me at Las Vegas was the covered, not chocolate actually, the biscuits that you're selling now.
Yes.
What's going on with that? Why are you selling cookies?
Why are we selling cookies? Okay. You've got to move to the south side of the Pyrenees because, as I said before, let's remember that the Basque country is not a French region. It's not a Spanish region. It's an actual country that lies across the border. So north side of the Pyrenees and south side of the Pyrenees as well. The south side of the Pyrenees is a lot bigger region. It's got four provinces. You have the larger cities, Bilbao, you have San Sebastian. And just like in every large region, you have different specialties of food throughout the territory. And south of the Pyrenees, close to San Sebastian, there's a tradition of making almond tiles and little butter biscuit cigarillos.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so part of the Agour group, you have the cheese category, charcuterie, and we also make sweet products. So we do make those biscuits in Tolosa, which is a city close to San Sebastian. And we also make Basque cheesecake, which is becoming a thing around the world now. People have started traveling to San Sebastian a lot and I've starting to take that recipe back with them. Everywhere in Japan, Turkey, the US. So we do make those types of products as well.
Oh my goodness. I'll have to look out for the cheesecake then.
I'm
glad you're stepping into dessert land, you know. I mean, the cigarillos, the basically what they look like, a cigar cookie, sometimes covered in chocolate, sometimes not, has been a favorite of mine recently. So good job getting those going in the US.
Thanks.
Yeah. Guillaume, I just want to say thank you for coming on the show today. This was fun.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully we helped some cheesemongers out there and people who love osoyrati know a little more about the cheese and now some Bayonne ham as well and cookies. it's all good. Okay, well, I just want to tell the listeners where they can follow you on Instagram. So, hey guys, please follow Guillaume on Instagram at Guillaume Dupont. And you can follow Maison Agour at Maison underscore Agour, A-G-O-U-R. And you can follow us at Cutting the Curd and myself at Kara Warren. So please listen, subscribe to Cutting the Curd via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, one more little reminder, the ACS scholarships are open for application. So please visit cheesesociety.org/scholarship if you're interested in applying for a scholarship to this year's conference. All right, guys, thanks and eat more cheese.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.